Welcome back again to BadQuaker.com podcast. My name is Ben Stone. This is podcast number 222 for Thursday, November 1st, 2012. And with me today is a very special guest. And instead of just introducing him, and I didn't let him know ahead of time that I was going to do this. I meant to, and then I forgot. Before I introduce Will Coley, I'm gonna see if I can get him to play a little game with me of 20 questions. Maybe not 20, but a couple questions. Just in case some of my audience doesn't know who Will Coley is. Will, first off, welcome to the show.
Thank you. Glad to be here.
Now, you're just on a few yes or no questions. You're from the South, is that correct?
Yes.
You consider yourself a Southerner.
I grew up in Appalachia.
Now, do you consider yourself, so you're not foreign born, you're an American, you're a good American, right?
Yeah, I guess you could say that.
Do you consider yourself a redneck?
I have been accused of that a time or two.
What are some of your activities that you do in your private life to just for the fun of it, not having anything to do with any of the topics we're going to talk about today?
Let's see here. Silver bug. I collect silver, melt down sterling silver scrap, and make my own ingots and stuff like that. I like to bow hunt. Go over to my dad's house and do some target shooting. That's pretty much my life is the activism I do. I go hunting every once in a while when I have the time. When holidays and birthdays and the occasional weekend that I actually don't have to work comes about, we take the kids and go over to my mom and dad's house out in Friendsville next to the river and shoot the shotgun and maybe grill a little bit. Or my mom still cans her own vegetables and stuff like that. We'll go over there and help them can and stuff like that. You know, just your average everyday life as far as I'm concerned.
Now I have one more question for you along these lines, since I'm, I'm like in a prosecutorial mode here.
Sure.
Do you now, or have you ever owned a pickup truck?
Well, I don't own one now cause I'm a family man now. I've got a 2-year-old and a 3-year-old. So we had to get rid of the truck. My first truck was a beat up old 84 Toyota pickup. And then I got rid of that and got a Ford, four-wheel drive, F-150, 83. And then drove that for a while and got rid of that. And drove a big Oldsmobile boat, Hurst Olds, the Hurst Olds with the Hurst Racing transmission and the his and her shift kit, the 79 with the black body and the brown hood. So, yeah, I've drove a truck a time or two, and I've driven quite a few tractors and grew up farming. We farmed and farmed tobacco and corn, and all the uncles and the cousins would get together and go over to one uncle's house and slaughter hogs, and then they'd all come to our house and we'd slaughter chickens. And so
now somebody might be scratching their head asking themselves why I'm asking you such weird questions. But I think I'm laying a groundwork here to say that you work with Davy Barker over there on MuslimsForLiberty.org, don't you? That's kind of your website.
Yeah. I am the national director for Muslims for Liberty.
And tell us just very quickly what brought you to Islam.
Well, unfortunately, that's not a quick story. It's filled with some strange circumstances and odd coincidences that somehow I ended up in a mosque. I'd never met Muslims before in my life. I just ended up in a mosque in Central Florida one Friday about 3 o'clock in the afternoon as they were locking the doors. And 3 weeks later, I was Muslim.
And now I got to ask you the dumb questions, like, do you want to kill Americans and do you want to blow things up and junk like that?
Wow, that's a hard question to answer honestly. Can we take certain people and say that they're not American? We just take them out of the equation and be like, you know, we'd be better off without this one, this one, this one. You know, let's see, Ben Bernanke, Obama, Romney. I'm not advocating that anyone commit violence, but I think society would be better off without about 90% of Congress, the Federal Reserve. But do I advocate going out and committing wanton destruction against civilian populations and things like that? Of course not. I think that we should find other ways to get rid of them. But unfortunately, the way things are looking, our country will end up in some kind of a revolution in the next 20 years in order for us to finally get it back from these people. By government standards, I guess you could say I'm a terrorist because I fit just about every single point on the watch list from right wing to Muslim. You know, I'm a Muslim. I would be considered a conservative Muslim. I wear a beard. My wife wears a hijab. And, we attend the mosque weekly. I'm involved in Islamic functions, attend Islamic events. So by the Department of Homeland Security's definition of a possible domestic Muslim extremist, that would be me. I'm a silver bug. I hoard. I am into organic and heirloom gardening. I'm into, providing for myself, including living off the land if absolutely necessary. I hoard precious metals. I do not agree with the government that we have. I don't agree with the Federal Reserve. So by the Department of Homeland Security's definition, I also fit pretty much everything to be a right-wing possible domestic terrorist. So, if you ask the government, I possibly could be. I go out, I do my stuff. I try to educate people. I try to help people understand the similarities and the differences in their way of doing things and our way of doing things. And, that's basically my job in life is to point out to both the American and the Muslim community the similarities in our viewpoints legally and socially, and try to build bridges between the different groups in our society based on those similarities.
The reason I was taking us down that path in discussion there is because oftentimes, like when I'm talking to my friend Michael Dean, or when Michael and Nima are talking on their podcast, the Freedom Fiends, we kind of joke around about getting droned all the time. It's kind of a running an ongoing joke that we got to watch what we say. We're going to get droned. But in all honesty, and as America moves into the future that clearly is laid out for it, a person matching your description at some point in time is going to come under a serious threat of that kind of thing. I mean, that's basically what Obama did to a 16-year-old kid not all that long ago. He just wasn't on American soil at the time.
Yeah, and right wing and left wing alike have done everything they can to justify it. I actually saw a statement by Peter King a couple of days ago where he was asked at an event about a kill list, and his opinion was that Romney should keep the kill list because it is absolutely constitutional, his exact words, and that if Anwar Awlaki's 16-year-old son was killed, well, that's just the breaks, was his exact words. So, the right and the left alike are completely complacent in these extrajudicial killings and these unconstitutional carrying out of what they're calling justice, which is the absolute absence of justice.
And we need to point out, too, that kid was not killed as a byproduct of the explosion that killed the actual guy they were after. He was intentionally targeted separately on a different day in a different location, and he was with other kids that were around his age that were not even accused of any kind of crimes or being involved in any crimes, and he had never been accused of a crime. He was directly targeted simply because of who his father was.
Well, that, and he wasn't the only one. He was not the only child that was killed. There was another child, I believe a 15 or a 14-year-old child, who, like you said, was in no way, shape, form, or fashion involved at all. He was literally an innocent child bystander. And again, both the right and the left in our politicians and the right and the left in our media are completely complacent. They don't care. It doesn't mean anything to them. We murdered two children, one of whom was an American citizen. But as Peter King said, that's just the breaks.
That's unimaginable that someone would say that, you know? But it's true. I heard it, too.
Yeah. Gotta love Luke Rutkowski, man. He gets those people so agitated. I love it. I love it.
Now, I should give a proper introduction for you. You were really involved early on with the Tea Party, and some of your expertise, if we can put it that way, is in Islamic history, interfaith relations, Islamic law, what people often call Sharia law. And try to clarify for us a little bit what, because that word gets thrown around, Sharia gets thrown around, and a lot of Americans really are confused about it. Can you kind of clarify it for us and let us know what the actual meaning is?
Well, the word itself doesn't really have much of a meaning. I mean, to translate it literally, it means the well-worn path to water. But it's first of all, not a monolith. If someone ever comes to you and says, Sharia says this, or the Sharia says this, or Islamic law says this, I would really be kind of skeptical of them and suspicious of them, because first of all, there is no the Sharia. Sharia is interpreted and reinterpreted depending on school of thought, depending on local culture, depending on what's going on in the time. Different things are interpreted and applied in different ways. You have four major schools of Islamic jurisprudence in Sunni Islam. You have the Maliki school, which I study. You have the Hanafi school, the Hanbali school, and the Shafi'i school. Now, to give you a simple idea of it, I'll go with something really simple like shellfish, okay? Now, according to, or just animals that come from the water. Now, according to the Maliki and the Shafi'i school, if it lives in the water more of its life than it lives on land, it's considered a water animal and therefore permissible for you to consume it as food. Okay. Now for the Hanafis, they don't follow that. They follow the Torah. Anything that lives in the water that has scales, you can consume, but you cannot consume shellfish. You cannot consume shark, catfish,
jellyfish,
anything that lives in the water that doesn't have scales, including fish, is for your consumption. And they base this on their understanding that, well, there's nothing in the hadith collections, the collections of actions and sayings that are reportedly or allegedly attributed to Muhammad sallallahu alaihi wasallam, that there's no traditions that show him eating shellfish. We lived in the middle of the desert, so I mean, that kind of makes sense, that if there was no shellfish, so of course he didn't eat shellfish, because, well, there wasn't any. So the Shafi'is and the Malikis look at what the Quran says. The Quran says, anything that comes from the water has been made permissible for you to eat. Even animals that have died of natural causes, which is the only thing that you're allowed to eat that's died of natural causes, is fish. So you see the difference in this is law. The Hanafi law on consumption of seafood is only fish with scales. The Shafi'i and the Maliki opinion of law for the same exact issue is anything that lives in water longer than it lives on land. These are both valid opinions in Sharia. There is a disagreement among schools on the issue, but both issues are valid. Both of them have valid evidences that support the view. So you see how big of a difference there can be on something as small as eating fish.
In many ways, that makes it a lot like pre-1600 English law, where it was a traditional law that was known and it was even studied, but it wasn't necessarily a written A, B, C, D type law.
Sharia is written, but it's like I said, it's interpreted differently depending on the school of law. And then you'll have differences of opinion within a school of law. Like, you'll have Maliki scholars that disagree on the permissibility of abortion. You know, the ijma, the consensus, the largest Maliki opinion is that abortion is only allowed if there is a direct threat of death to the mother. End of story. But then you have some scholars within the Maliki school that have adopted the Shafi'i view, which is that up to the 40th day, or no, up to the 14th week, that's it. Up to the 14th week, you can have an abortion, because according to other Islamic sources, the child's body hasn't been given a soul yet. That at a certain point in gestation, an angel comes and breathes a soul of life into the baby in the stomach. And from that point on, it's treated as an ensouled human being with all the same rights and privileges as any other person that walks the face of the earth. If you knock a woman down a flight of stairs who's pregnant, you will be charged with murder if that child dies. Or if it's an accident, you will be required to pay the blood price. You will be required to financially compensate the family for the loss of the child.
This is a good place to introduce the difference between what we might think of as Muslim law and what we might think of as nation states that try to inflict Muslim law upon their people. Can you distinguish the difference between those two?
Can you repeat
it? Sure. What I'm trying to get at is that there's a difference between people who voluntarily follow Sharia because they're Muslims, and governments that force what they perceive as Sharia law upon their citizens. Define for me the difference between the government doing that and individuals doing it through a voluntary process.
Well, individuals doing it through a voluntary process would be like the Muslim villages that you see popping up in the Caribbean, or small, I guess you would call them like Muslim collectives that are popping up across the globe, or the way that Sharia is practiced here in the U.S., or the way that Halakha law, the Bet Din courts of the Jewish community is practiced here in the U.S. I do not see anything in any government on the face of the planet right now that I can look at and say this is all in keeping with what the scholars have stated is proper according to the jurisprudence of Islamic legal theory. The laws and regulations that are enforced in most of these self-professed Muslim countries are tribal or cultural norms that are being enforced on the people in the name of enforcing a religious law without actually doing so. Saudi Arabia is the easiest example. Well, Saudi Arabia's monetary system is a paper fiat monetary system. Paper money is forbidden in Islam. It holds no intrinsic value. The Saudi Arabian government trades oil with the United States. The United States government is currently unapologetically killing Muslim civilians in four different Muslim countries. According to some of the oldest manuscripts of the understanding of jurisprudence, you are not, as a Muslim, allowed to trade anything whatsoever that could in any way assist an enemy that is killing Muslims. I think trading oil with the United States is assisting the United States, because that oil is then converted into fuel that is used for tanks, planes, Humvees. If you took the oil, it would destabilize the United States economy and they wouldn't be able to wage the war. I mean, there's so many arguments that show that if Saudi Arabia didn't trade oil with the U.S., that the amount of Muslim civilians that they killed would have to go down drastically, because they wouldn't be able to sustain it. They either wouldn't be able to fuel the vehicles to do so, or the economy would be in a shambles because they couldn't get the fuels in necessary to keep the economy going. So Saudi Arabia, I guess, would be the easiest, most glaring example. They signed on to the Bretton Woods Accords. The Bretton Woods Accords state that you're not allowed to use gold and silver as a currency. Well, the most basic understanding of any interpretation of Sharia states that gold and silver are what is to be used as currency. So Saudi Arabia signed a contract forbidding what God made permissible, which isn't just blasphemy, it's idolatry. For you to sign a contract and agree to a law from another source that literally says, even though God says this is okay, it's illegal. That is idolatry. It's shirk. For a Muslim government to sign that legislation is shirk in the most simplest of definitions. Because the Prophet Muhammad sallallahu in his lifetime said that the Jews and the Christians took their scholars as gods. And the argument that was given to the given in return was, well, we never worshipped them. And he says, but did you allow him to tell you what was right and what was wrong above what God has said? And they said, well, yes. And they said, well, then that is what is God to you. Because when God says this is okay and they says it's wrong, you went with them. And when God said it was wrong and they said it was okay, you went with them. So you put them before God, which is idolatry. So we have idolatrous governments running the Muslim world right now in the name of enforcing this thing that they like to call Sharia law.
That's pretty anarchist. Not just for you saying it, but that's pretty anarchist in the sense that that all of the examples that we have of Islamic nation states are essentially breaking some of the fundamentals of Islam.
Well, yeah, they're socialist dictatorships or they're socialist monarchies, and monarchy and dictatorship are both forbidden in Islam. The Prophet Muhammad specifically stated that he came to do away with the concept that one man is more fit to rule or govern a people simply because of who his father was, that no man is greater than any man simply based on his tribe, his culture, his lineage, whose parents were, what color he is, what gender they are, that all of these things mean nothing to God. And should mean nothing to mankind, especially in a role of leadership, that we should choose the righteous and upright from among us, not he's the next one in line when dad dies. But that's what exists in all of the Gulf states. All the Gulf states are run by either monarchies or socialist dictatorships. And then when you look at the other countries, Egypt, dictatorship just became a pseudo-democracy, not really looking for that to go well. Tunisia, I'm glad that they got their thing settled. Pakistan has, I don't even know what you want to call what goes on in Pakistan and Afghanistan. It's supposed to be a government, but who exactly it represents has never really been clear to the public or to the people. So it saddens me. It really does. It makes me really sad. And I'm not the only one. There's a lot of other people out here that are like this. Some of us have even been arrested. You know, there was a Canadian activist last year who spoke out against Saudi Arabia in Canada and then went for the Hajj pilgrimage and was arrested.
Wow.
For what he said about Saudi Arabia in Canada. A white dude. Nobody heard about this. Now, if a guy got kidnapped in Afghanistan or Pakistan, it would be on, you know, 6 o'clock news, 11 o'clock news, and the 24-hour news broadcast for the next 6 weeks. But a white guy gets kidnapped basically by the Saudi Arabian government for speaking out against the Saudi Arabian government in his own home country, and the media is like, I didn't see nothing.
Amazing. I'm going to break here and save this file, and we're going to come right back with more on this topic, and we're going to go slightly in a different direction with Will Coley. BadQuaker.com uses HostGator as our web hosting service. It was fast and easy to get set up, and the support we receive is top-notch. They have helpful and friendly 24/7, 365 live technical support and a 99.9% uptime guarantee, and they have some of the best prices in the business. If you have a website, or if you want to have a website, check them out by going to BadQuaker.com and click on the button for HostGator. And thank you very much for supporting BadQuaker.com. Did you know author Taryn P. Lupo has a new novel out called One Nation Under Blood? When a rejuvenative blood technology is developed that pits the young against the old, the government must take firm steps to address the war of supply and demand brewing across generational lines. Blood is not the only thing bought and sold in this dystopian tale of technology, economics, and independence. Vampires are now very real, but we never expected them to wear our grandmother's best Sunday dress. And thanks for sticking with me through the commercial break. This is Ben Stone with BadQuaker.com podcast. And with me today is Will Coley. And we're talking about Islam, and we're talking about Sharia law, and we're talking about the dictatorships and other despots around the world that claim to be Muslim and claim to have Islamic countries. But that's not really the case. You mentioned Saudi Arabia, and I think it's really kind of funny because anybody who's really looked at the history of Saudi Arabia will realize that there is no such thing as Saudi Arabia. It's two contradicting terms, isn't it?
Yes. According to the Sunnah, which is the actions, again, it's another way of saying the hadith. It's the mannerisms, the example given by the Prophet Muhammad, sallallahu alaihi wasallam. The land that is now known as Saudi Arabia, according to Muhammad, should always be known simply as Al-Arabiya, Arabia. That's it. Just Arabia, the land of the Arabs. Not Al-Arabiya Al-Saud, which is the land of the Saudis. That's not what it was meant to even be named. So the name itself, the name of Saudi Arabia itself, is a violation of Islam.
And they came to power under pretty nasty circumstances at the end of World War One, where they had.
No. You're way too far in the future. You need to rewind at least 60 years before that. When the
oh really
the British were trying this we're talking around World War One, before World War One, when the British were trying to destabilize the Ottoman Empire,
mm-hmm.
and they were paying in the late 1700s they were paying a self-professed mufti named Muhammad ibn Abdul Wahhab al-Najd, who had come up with this idea that he was the only Muslim on the face of the earth and that every Muslim on the planet had been committing idolatry and practicing the wrong religion for the previous 600 years. And he got with a couple members of the British Secret Service, and they paid him. They funded him £5,000 a month.
Wow.
They sent him to spread his message. He actually led an army and tried to, and he made the killing of Muslims that disagreed with him permissible, including scholars. He was, there were books written by his own brother and his own father, refuting him and his views. He was, criticized and rejected by all the top scholars of all four major schools of thought of his time. And he formed an alliance with the Al-Saud family because he needed political clout in Arabia to go along with his political clout he was getting from the UK. And they led an army and tried to sack Mecca. And they were defeated, and the ideology was beaten back for to the late 1800s, early 1900s. When the cloak and dagger stuff started with the UK again, trying to destabilize the Ottomans. And they started first with an Ottoman defector, and they were paying him, I think they paid him like £4 million. It's some ungodly number in the millions that they paid him in British sterling pounds, basically to go in and take over Mecca and the area of the Hejaz. Right after World War One, when everything was in chaos and the Ottoman Empire was being dismantled and everything else, this guy goes in and he takes over. Well, he wants to establish an independent state that doesn't grovel at the feet of the UK. So the UK finds this out, and they decide to side with the Al-Saud family, and the I want to say ancestor, but I'm going, that's backwards. The progeny of Abdul Wahhab, because these two families are still in alliance with each other. And they pay Al-Saud as well, but they don't give him near as much money as they give the other guy, whose name still is not popping in my head for some reason. So they pay Al-Saud and fund Al-Saud. And then there's this thing, that movie everybody knows about, Lawrence of Arabia.
Mm-hmm.
That was all a part of it. Sending in the British, sending in military, sending in weapons, sending in money, doing everything that they could to support the Al-Saud family in overthrowing the Ottomans in Saudi Arabia, in modern day Saudi Arabia, in the land of Hijaz. And then as soon as they were successful on the battlefield, England immediately recognized them as a country, which got them recognized by all the rest of the international bodies, and bam, Saudi Arabia exists. Just as cloak and dagger as what happened with Israel and the Balfour declarations. It was literally as bloodthirsty, as ruthless, wholesale wanton killing of civilians by both the UK and by the Al-Saud Abdul Wahhab alliance. And it was literally taking power of a country against the will of the people who live there through brutal force and absolute terrorist style tactics, all with the assistance of the United Kingdom. And then later the United States under Franklin Roosevelt decided that he would put his own 2 cents and start sending money and assistance to keep them in power. And that's where we are now. We have a Saudi government that is completely oppressive and repressive to both its citizenry and to the Muslim world in general, with their funding of terrorism. Our government knows and has known for 25 years the single largest contributors to global terrorism are the Al-Saud family. So they fund the murder of Muslims. They fund the murder of non-Muslims. And all of this is done with the money that is sent to them by the United States and the United Kingdom, with the knowledge that they will use the money for this purpose of both the United States and the United Kingdom. We know that they will use the money for this purpose, and we still send it to them.
All you have to do really is look at a map of the area and see how straight the lines are between these countries, and think for yourself. These are not borders that were created naturally as countries develop. There were basically English and French map makers that sat down and drew lines on a map and said, this is going to be this country, this is going to be that country. And then the English put puppet leaders in control of those countries.
Winston Churchill actually stated that he drew up the first half of the Middle East before tea and finished the second half after. That's a quote from Churchill, that he sat down and he drew the map just before and just after tea time.
What do you think would happen if America had some turmoil and China came in and decided to just create borders between where the U.S. and Canada and Mexico, or between, say, even Texas and Arkansas? How do you think people in America would react to that kind of a situation?
Well, I think first they would turn against China, but we're not dealing with the same kind of society here in the U.S. that you're dealing with in Arabia at the turn of the century. You know, you're looking at a portion of the globe that was developmentally was 200 years behind the rest of the planet. So I don't think that we would react by attacking each other, which is what happened in the 40s in the Middle East. But they drew those lines purposely. You know, they take Kurdistan and cut it into four pieces and put it into four separate countries to make sure that the Kurds are always going to want their own nation back. You know, it'd be like if, like what's going on in Texas and Mexico. The Mexicans feel that they're not trespassing. A lot of them, when I lived in Texas, feel they're not trespassing. That Mexico is their country. It's their land. It's their, the Texas and New Mexico and Arkansas is their ancestral land. That it belongs to them. And that we came in and we took away their land. So what do? They come across the border and reclaim it. I mean, how many How many wars did we fight? How many border wars were there over the annexation of Texas? You know, look at it in the historical context of, well, what has happened when the United States has been had similar things like this happen here? When the United States annexed Texas and decided to redraw the lines for the western southern United States and Mexico, Mexico got mad and we fought a war over it.
And those, you know, people in the Middle East are basically they're just like all other people. There's no magic reason to hate, you know, hate them or think that they're in some way barbaric and would react in some different way.
Well, yeah, people are people. If you take my house, I'm going to fight you. If you kill my wife, I'm going to fight you. If you harm my children, I'm going to fight you. If you harm my family, I'm going to fight you. If you attack my community and my neighbors, I'm going to fight you. I'm going to stand up to you. That's, well, at least that's the way people were when my father was growing up. If you harmed his neighbor, it was his job and his dad and his brother's job to come and try to protect the neighbor's house, just like the neighbor would, because everybody is connected in a community like that.
I look at the anti-Muslim propaganda right now that's so prominent in just every direction, and I find it very cartoonish, but I also think that it's very much like the anti-anarchist propaganda that was prevalent around 1900. You know, pretty much everything in society, anything that happened that was bad around 1900, it was blamed on the crazy anarchists. They were demonized both in Europe and in the U.S. They were blamed for pretty much everything that happened, whether they had any involvement in it or not.
Sacco and Vanzetti.
Yeah, exactly. And oftentimes, there would be infiltration by police into an anarchist group, and there would be so many police in the group that really there were almost no non-police in the anarchist group. And then they would decide to do something violent and then arrest, you know, one or more of the members who were basically just stooges in it anyway.
Yeah.
And now we're seeing the FBI using those exact same tactics in the U.S., with people. They're basically creating a reason to arrest somebody and then arresting them for it.
Well, yeah. I mean, you can't justify the usurpation of civil liberties to people at home on a massive scale without offering them at least a quarterly reason. You know, about every 3 months we have a new fake terrorist attack. At least once a year we have where the FBI has gone out, actively recruited a person. The only person who wasn't a member of the FBI that's involved, you know, is the stooge. It's like six guys, they're all terrorists, but actually they're all FBI except for the one poor sucker who, I mean, even like with the guy in Oregon, he tried to leave. He was like, you know what? I really don't want to be a part of this. I've changed my mind. I want to go work on a fishing boat in Alaska and get my life together. And the government did everything they could to block his ability to leave Oregon. Like, the guy didn't want to go through it. He had changed his mind. But they needed their patsy. So they blocked this guy's moving away to start his life over in a different direction. They did everything they could to prevent this man from being able to start his life again somewhere else. He didn't want to be involved in it. He changed his mind. Well, you're not allowed to change your mind because we've already put all this money and, you know, Christmas is, we got to have a terrorist attack this year. Come on. Christmas is coming. Just so you know, there'll be one in about a month. I don't have any connections to Al-Qaeda or anything. I'm just looking at, since Obama's been in office, there's been a fake attempted terrorist attack within a week of Christmas every single year.
Yeah.
Now, when Bush was in office, there wasn't a fake terrorist attack every year at Christmas that the FBI put together themselves, or they purposely let somebody on the no-fly list on an airplane, you know, all of these things. That didn't happen when Bush was in office. But since Obama's been in office, every year at Christmas, there's been a fake thwarted terrorist attack. So just so you know, here in about a month, we're going to be hearing about somebody trying to blow up a plane or set fire to a Christmas tree, or something's going to happen. Nobody's going to get hurt. The feds are going to be the one that put the whole thing together. And some 22-year-old guy from Bangladesh is going to be the bad guy.
Yep. It's pretty predictable, really.
Yeah. I mean, it's gotten to the point that you can just sit back and be like, okay, it's almost Christmas, fake terrorist attack time. I mean, it's sad. When did we get to this place in our society where we now can plan false flags attacks by our watch?
Yeah, and it's really pretty messed up, too, because they're obviously false flag. It's false flag violence. And even when, you know, what was it that happened the other day? Not the other day, but not long ago. Oh, I know what it was. It was the attacks on the American embassy in, I can't remember the name of the city.
In Benghazi.
But yeah, exactly. And immediately, and that happened on 9/11 of 2012. And immediately, the first stories that the government comes out with are all lies.
Yeah.
And so then it admits to those lies and it lays out another whole series of lies.
Yeah.
And then it gets caught in those lies. And it's like, you know, why do these people believe anything the government says?
Now, on the Benghazi thing, let me give you a couple of things that haven't really been put out in the mass media, a couple little bitty nuggets of fact for your listeners to chew on. First, that video had been in existence since June. It had been on YouTube and on the internet and completely accessible to anybody that wanted to see it since June. It was translated into Arabic by a Kingdom of Saudi Arabia owned television station that had recently opened up in Egypt after the revolution. You know, Saudi Arabia, our quote unquote best friend in the Middle East. And then that sparks off all of these riots that are encouraged by Saudi scholars in these different countries. And then that video is used as our government's excuse for why all these things happen. It seems rather odd to me that first of all, Mitt Romney, while it was still going on, the blood was still warm, the shells were and bullets were still flying, Mitt Romney already had a statement released. Two minutes after it was released to the public that it had even happened, Mitt Romney had a statement, professionally prepared statement, already out there in the public sphere. How do you do that? How do you have a professionally prepared public statement on an event released 2 minutes after it's released to the public that it's even happened? And Saudi Arabia's, they're way too involved in this for me to feel comfortable that all of this wasn't purposely orchestrated, that our government and Saudi Arabia's government didn't put this whole thing together on purpose.
Let me interrupt you right there and save this file, and we'll take a break and come back.
Would you like to do something to support BadQuaker.com? Here's how easy it is. If you're already going to buy something from Amazon, go to BadQuaker.com first. Click on any of the buttons for Amazon. Once at Amazon, shop like you normally would. You'll pay the same price for the things you buy from Amazon, but Amazon will give BadQuaker.com a tiny portion of that purchase. It's amazingly easy to shop at Amazon, it won't cost you any extra, and you'll be supporting BadQuaker.com. Thank you.
And thanks for sticking with me through the commercial. And I want to stay with this topic. We're talking about the events of 9/11/2012. And Will, that city name escaped my mind again. What was it?
Benghazi.
Yeah, Benghazi. Okay. I should reintroduce myself and my guest. This is Ben Stone with Bad Quaker Podcast, and with me is Will Coley. And you know, there's some other odd things about that attack. For instance, there were drones that were monitoring the entire thing live, and there was a Spectre a gunship that was right there available that could have shut the whole thing down within a matter of a couple minutes. Mm-hmm. And eventually, what did interrupt the process was some general, I can't remember his name, took it upon himself to break orders and send in relief to help the people out. And he was immediately relieved of command when he did that, when he broke because the U.S. government had the ability to stop that whole process right as it started. And for some reason, they chose to hold people back and not go in and stop the battle. Are you aware of all those things?
Yeah, I've kept pretty close tabs on some of the stuff that's happened with that What I was talking about, the odd facts, the first is the glaring fact that it looks like the United States and this Kingdom of Saudi Arabia were somehow involved in the video release and translation together purposely, possibly to act as an excuse for this Benghazi attack, or possibly to act as an excuse to get the entire Muslim world in an uproar for, you know, to justify other quote unquote kinetic military excursions. And another detail that was just the fact that it really wasn't pushed in the mainstream media, it upsets me to such a great degree that I really don't even have words for it. The day after the events on 9/11, 2012, the people of Benghazi, 30,000 protesters in the streets of Benghazi, protesting against this armed militant group, U.S. funded Al Qaeda affiliate that we pumped money and weapons into, by the way, they were so angry that they stormed the compound of this Al Qaeda stronghold and burned it to the ground. They drove the terrorists out of Benghazi and turned their compounds over to the military, the actual Libyan military. Why was this not front page news? Why was the fact that the people of Benghazi were so upset and offended by the fact that an American ambassador was killed on their soil that they literally burned out the perpetrators?
Yeah.
Now, I see this story being released by small indie media or by overseas media. And then I see in social media all of the, why don't the Muslims ever speak out when people do bad things? This is just another example of how people do bad things and Muslims just don't care. When are the Muslims going to stand up and say something? This is why I don't like Muslims, is because they do these bad things and then nobody ever stands up and condemns it. Excuse me? I think 30,000 protesters in the streets burning down the building of the people who did it is a pretty strong condemnation. Oh, wait, that's right. I forgot. The media doesn't want you to know about those things.
And the media has a lot to gain from keeping Americans stupid on the topic.
Absolutely. Well, that and the people who make money off of war that, you know, buy the advertisements on their television programs have far more to gain from keeping Americans stupid on this. It's a myth. It's probably one of the most widely accepted and mainstream myths about Muslims, especially here in the U.S., that exists. You know, Muslims, when this happened in Benghazi, a guy I know personally, his brother goes to the mosque with me here in Knoxville, Tennessee. His brother is a student at the university that my wife works at. His brother, Tariq El-Masidi, who now lives in Ohio, started a campaign through Celebrate Mercy, which was something that he had set up to honor Muhammad. And they were able to get over 7,000 letters of condolences for Ambassador Stevens from across the globe, from Egypt, from Pakistan, from the United States, from Afghanistan, from Somalia, from all over the globe, 7,000 letters of condolences, even getting a letter back from the wife and sister of Ambassador Stevens. I mean, from the wife, but the sister of Ambassador Stevens wrote a letter to Tariq thanking him for his efforts to honor her brother's memory. BBC covered that story.
Bill O'Reilly's not going to mention it.
Well, hell no, Bill O'Reilly's not going to mention it. Neither is Sean Hannity, neither is Limbaugh, neither is Mark Levine, neither is Bort. None of these people are going to mention it. MSNBC didn't mention it.
You know, I always find it odd, too, that let's just pick out a single country. We were picking on Saudi Arabia earlier, but let's pick on, a dead guy. Let's pick on Saddam Hussein. Whenever Saddam would do something stupid or whatever, the media would always remind us that it was a Muslim country. And this is what Muslims do. See how Saddam Hussein is behaving. But the thing of it is,
Saddam was atheist.
Say that again.
Saddam was an atheist.
Yeah.
He was a Baathist. The Baath Party is a secular, socialist, non-religious political party. He embraced his Islamic faith. According to most sources, he embraced his Islamic faith about 2 years before he died.
Saying that Saddam Hussein or his country or his government, I'm talking about, to say that they were a representative in any way of Islam is kind of like assuming that Stalin and Stalin's government was and anything they did was Christian. It's just goofy.
Yeah, pretty much. But that doesn't keep the narrative going, though. You're violating the narrative, Ben. You've got to stick to the narrative. You're not allowed to stray. You have to stick to the narrative. You know, when I go out and I give a lecture at a university and I say the five basic foundational principles of Islamic legal theory exist in the Declaration of Independence, three of those five were borrowed by John Locke, and that's where Thomas Jefferson got those ideas. They don't want to hear that because, well, that's not following the narrative. The narrative is, no, there are three principles in Sharia law. Kill non-Muslims, beat women, and wear a towel on your head. You know, those are the three principles of Islamic law. They're not the protection of life, the protection of religious liberty, the protection of lineage, the protection of private property, the protection of dignity. These aren't the foundational principles of Sharia law. No. Even though that's what's been written, were the foundational principles of Islamic law for 1,300 years, that doesn't mean anything. We what it is, and that makes it fact. And you actually had a guy tell me one time, Islam doesn't come from books. So if I want to know about what Islam is, I need to stop reading books of Islamic jurisprudence. I need to stop studying the scholars of antiquity. I need to stop reading the Quran, stop reading the Hadith traditions, and just watch television and see what Al-Qaeda does. And that's what Muslims do. That's what Islam is. Because Islam doesn't come from books, even though book and the Hadith are all in books and the fiqh is all in books. And, you know, it all comes from books, but Islam doesn't come from books. And that's my problem, according to these people, is that I have a bad understanding of what Islam is because I'm learning about Islam from books and they learn about Islam from YouTube. So their information has got to be far superior to my information because their information tells them that they're right.
A lot of people don't realize, too, that, you know, if you take out the last 100 years out of the mix, you take out of the mix all the interference that the West has had into the Islamic world, Christians and Jews, Christian and Jewish communities, that is, have existed all over the Middle East for a couple thousand years. And they're relatively peaceful interactions with everyone.
Yeah, we'll see. And just like any other society, like we have our bad apples here. We had, you know, I'm a fan of Andrew Jackson, but his policy toward the indigenous peoples of the United States were deplorable and absolutely unacceptable and inexcusable. That was a black eye in our history. It was a dark smudge on the history of our country, what Andrew Jackson did to the American Indians. Well, you have that kind of thing happening in the Islamic history as well. There's a story about a leader, a caliph is what he's described as, who took a church in Syria. There was a Syrian church and he took possession of it against the will of the owners of the church and converted it into a mosque. And his successor took power. He was known by the people as a righteous man who followed Islam. I mean, this is the way that the story, the traditions describe it, is that this man was known as a righteous man who followed Islam and followed the Sharia. That's how he's described, a righteous man who knew Islam and followed the law, the way that Islam requires that people follow it. So the Christians whose church had been taken came to him because they knew he was just, and they told him what his predecessor had done. And he ordered that the governor of Syria give the property back to the Christians, just give it back. And if the Christians aren't happy with us returning the property to them, we will build them a new church, negotiate a sum, so that we can replace this house of worship that was taken unjustly from them. So this gives you an idea of, see, not every Muslim ruler was a good person.
Right.
You know, just like people, Christianity is a decent religion. Christians suck. Islam is a great religion. Muslims suck. Just be honest.
Because humans are humans.
Humans are terrible people. No matter what religion we decide to say that we are a part of, humans in general are just really not that great. And we have the ability to be evil, oppressive SOBs to other people. So it happens. It's happened more than once throughout Muslim history where a power-hungry, money-hungry, bad ruler did things that were unjust, that were he felt were in his own personal best interest for his own power and his own wealth. And then other rulers came and undid the bad that they did to the best of their ability. Like this one specific ruler going so far as to say, look, we'll give you this property back. And if the property being given back to you, because it had been remodeled, it had been turned into a mosque. So it no longer looked like a church. And it had, you know, Arab, it's Syria, so it would have had Arabic writing anyway. But it had Muslim, you know, things written and stuff on the walls. So if you're not happy with the building as it is now, then we will build you a new one because what happened to you was wrong. This is an example of justice. You know, this guy before did something completely evil to you. And our own presidents have had to do this before as well. Our own, we just apologized, 10 years ago for the internment camps of the 1940s against the Japanese.
Right.
You know, reparations for the Japanese for internment. So we've had our own things where our society and our leaders have violated some of the most basic tenets of our society's legal system. We have leaders that have violated, they have danced on the Constitution, and then we've had leaders that had to come later. Sometimes, I mean, at least with the church, with the Muslims, it was the very next guy. The poor Japanese had to wait 40 years for an I'm sorry.
Yeah, Native Americans, Indians in America that are still within the reservations, many of those reservations have the legal classification still, even today, that they are prisoner of war camps.
And they've still never gotten an apology, really.
Yeah. Yeah, they literally, there are reservations that the government of the United States still considers prisoner of war camps. They are given numbers. The numbers that they are, you know, signify their location to the federal government are classified as prisoner of war camps.
Oy vey.
And that's not considered, you know, most people don't think, well, you know, that's what the Christians are doing. They don't consider that a Christian activity. They realize that it's the government that does that, not Christianity, but yet you can't get them to think that same way when a government in the Middle East does something like that. You think right away, well, that's them Muslims doing that. You know?
Yeah, I just got into a discussion today about the nuance that is allowed in discussion that is basically thrown out the window when Muslims are when Nidal Hassan took a rifle and killed a bunch of people at Fort Hood, it was because he was Muslim. That was it. That was the only reason possible. He couldn't have mental health issues. He couldn't have economic issues. He couldn't have any issues other than the fact he's Muslim. Therefore, that's why he did it. Colorado shooting spree, 15 reasons why he did it. Tons of excuses. Jared Loughner, when they were trying to say that guy was attached to the Tea Party, 5,000 excuses from Fox News as to, first of all, why he wasn't a part of the Tea Party. And second of all, why if he was, there must have been something wrong. He was crazy, he had financial issues, he had, you know, something. Or the soldier, the staff sergeant, who killed 16 Afghan civilians last year, including women and children. There was tons of excuse and nuance offered as to why he did this. He'd been deployed too many times. Oh, there was a bomb that blew up too close to him. Oh, he had post-traumatic stress. Oh, he drank too much. Oh, he was having family issues. His house got foreclosed. There was all these reasons and all of this nuance that was offered as to, well, why it might not be justifiable or excusable, but it kind of is. But when a Muslim commits the same act, none of that counts. None of it's even entertained. Like, the guy could have just got out of the mental hospital yesterday and then went and blew something up. He did it because he was Muslim. The fact that he was in the mental hospital yesterday isn't even acknowledged. It's like it didn't even happen. So the nuance is not there. We're able to look and see all the details of a story except for on this one specific issue.
And this is pretty obvious, too, or it should be to people. Especially when you realize who is making up this, the storyline that we're supposed to always believe.
Yeah. Well, of course, we're going to find excuses for why the military-industrial complex slaughters people because, well, I mean, our economy is based on the military-industrial complex now. So you kind of have to. You got to make excuses for the only profitable portion of our economy.
We've almost hit our deadline, our limit on time here, but I wanted to throw out one other thing. You know, if you go backwards in time, I'm pretty old, so I remember some stuff from like the 60s and things. And back then, the horrible evil people of the day were communists. Mm-hmm. And it was we were in Vietnam to save the world from the communists, and we had to constantly watch out because the communists were going to get us. But then an odd thing happened. And the Soviet Union, because of their socialist fiscal policies, the Soviet Union fell apart, and we didn't have a boogeyman anymore. And but prior to that time, if you go back into the 60s and early 70s, travelers could go all over the Middle East safely without any problem whatsoever, and Muslims were not the boogeyman. It was only when we ran out of our other boogeyman that we needed, we needed a new boogeyman.
And we ran out of Iran, too. Remember, we got kicked out of Iran, and Iran no longer wanted to play the same game with us that Saudi Arabia played. So we did.
Well,
they're starting the Muslim boogeyman right about that time.
Yeah, that gave us a good excuse to have somebody else to utilize. And I should throw in, too, a lot of people don't realize how much money the CIA pumped into Afghanistan in the 70s and early 80s to develop radical strains of Islamic thought for the purpose of combating the Soviet Union.
Well, we also the textbooks in the Pakistani, Afghani, and Palestinian schools that are always the subject of such ire in our media. They always leave out the biggest detail in the story, which is that they were printed at the University of Nebraska.
Right.
You know,
with CIA money.
The textbooks that radicalized these people that are our excuse for why they're so evil. Well, look what their school books say. We printed them here in the U.S. and then sent them back over there. So if there's anything in the school book that's objectionable, well, we kind of put it there.
Yeah, and then we want to bomb the school because of it.
Well, yeah, because that's, what is it, the Hegelian dialectic. You know, you create the problem, and then you've already got the solution already ready for it. Now look at me, I'm a hero, you know?
Well,
let me give some suggestions for reading for your listeners really quickly. A piece of work that was very influential on Thomas Locke was written by an Islamic legal philosopher named Ibn Tufayl in... It was translated into Latin by Edward Pocock, and it's called the Philosophicus Autodidacticus, and it is, according to Locke's own words, where he came up with a lot of his concepts of the right, the individual, the rights of the individual, and the concept of a man's intrinsic ability to tell right from wrong without societal influence. Rose Wilder Lane's Discovery of Freedom, or Islam and the Discovery of Freedom by Rose Wilder Lane, the godmother of libertarianism and late 19th and early 20th century writer and thinker. And you go to our website, muslimsforliberty.org, and read through some of our articles there that cover pretty much anything and everything you could ever want to know about the concepts of liberty and where they fit into the Islamic dichotomy, where some of the sources for our own Western freedoms in some cases actually originate in the Islamic legal tradition, and Islam and the Discovery and Islam and the Formulation of English Common Law by John McDeasy is another one that I would read for anybody that wants to know more about the kind of work that we do and the kind of message that we have and where we get our information from. They could always go to the website, and we have a book list there that has the names of works of Islamic scholarly
from antiquity where these ideas were, and then they were taken and changed and adapted and adopted over time into the Western legal traditions. You know, so there's four or five books there that you guys can take a look at if you guys are interested. And like I said, just take a look at the website or take a look at Dobby's website, San Francisco Muslim Examiner, which is for information.
And once again, that's Muslims for Liberty with the word Muslims and then the number four and then liberty.org.
Cool.
And you can always find the link over at badquaker.com also.
And I also write for the Libertarian Review, so you'll see some of my articles from time to time on the Libertarian Review as well. So if you're a follower there and you see stories about Muslims, that's usually me. So,
Will, I want to thank you for coming on the show with me, and an open invitation for you to come back on another time.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. Hopefully we're going to be minting our own silver currencies soon, getting molds to mint my own silver currency, having them made right now. So maybe when we get some of those done, I'll send you a couple silver rounds out.
Whoa, that'd be cool. And hey, you know what? Maybe we'll have a little listener contest whenever that happens. And maybe we can arrange something so that you and I can work together and have some kind of a listener contest.
That would be maybe. Cool, yeah.
Again, Will Coley is my guest. Will, thank you very much for coming on BadQuaker.com podcast. And for more on liberty, property, and the Zero Aggression Principle, go to BadQuaker.com.